Welcome to The Right Chamber, the podcast that takes you inside the NHS to explore what really makes a hospital a hospital.
Each episode, we sit down with the people who keep healthcare moving, from doctors, nurses on the front line, to students, the support teams, administrators, corporate staff, and everyone in between. These are the voices that often go unheard, but together they form the heartbeat of our hospitals.
Our aim is simple: to share authentic stories that are accessible to the public, meaningful to NHS staff, and a reminder that healthcare is more than treatments and wards. It's a whole community working together.
So whether you're part of the NHS family or simply curious about the people behind the service, join us as we open the doors to the conversations that matter here in the Right Chamber. Nurse Paul Featherby Davis is passionate about evidence-based moving and handling education that ensures staff and patient safety while preventing deconditioning. He promotes collaboration and service improvement to optimise patient care, with a particular focus on supporting patients living with obesity. Welcome back to the Right Chamber podcast. My name is Jaspreet.
My name is Victor.
And today we have Paul Featherby Davis. Hi, Paul.
Hi.
Well, tell us about you and what you do, Paul.
Okay, yeah. I'm Paul. I'm a nurse by background. I've been a nurse for 23 years. I've worked here at Dudley since 2016, but I've been in education since 2022. Because I always feel that every day should be a school day, and that everywhere you should be delivering evidence-based practices. So obviously my philosophy is to try and give the fundamental knowledge to our workforce so it optimises our patient care and experience here in Trust.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like they teach us in medical school, see one, teach one, do one. But that teach one aspect is a huge part of the job, isn't it? Passing on the knowledge as you build and gain them.
So what do you teach?
Oh, sorry, I do apologise. So I look after moving, handling and core risk medical devices here in Trust. So primarily we are patient-facing trainers, but we also support the wider workforce to be at work, especially if they've got like long-term conditions or they've been off with a work-related injury. So we support the area managers to put risk assessments into place to support that individual back into work. A, helps with their mental health and well-being, but also it helps the patient receive the appropriate care by an appropriately skilled person. We do have bank shifts, again, but that person necessarily doesn't have the skill set for that area, where actually this individual would. So actually it has a benefits for both parties. And regarding medical devices, the core risk ones, so there's the portable oxygen, which is the cylinder. We've got your infusion pumps, so obviously your medium ones, so of your IV fluids. Then you obviously like your GH, your Larbis, which is for your diabetic management sliding scales. So then your small ones, and then your micro-managed ones, such as your McKinley T34s, which is more for your end-of-life care patients or patients that have got an unsafe swallow, so they need to have their medicine administered subcutaneously. We've got the portable air suction unit, which is on the deteriorated patient trolley. And then there's a whole riff of medium risk devices that we also cover at the same time. So we are aligned up to the MHRA, so to provide the assurance that we have got a competently skilled, trained workforce, again, provide evidence-based care to our patients.
Wow, absolutely. So that is quite broad range of medical devices, which would be very, very useful for the patient in their own home. So for the scope of your practice, you're not limited to the hospital then. You work both in hospital and out in the community.
Correct, yeah.
Okay. So like nursing homes and...
So unless they come under the DGFT, so the Dudley Group of Hospitals, we wouldn't necessarily get involved. Again, they will outsource their training to other from another provider. But those that are employed from Dudley Group, it's myself that'd be involved. And one of the examples I can give you, we had a fast track for one of our end-of-life care patients who was plus size, and the end-of-life care facilitators wanted support regarding moving and handling the individual. So we had the referral, which is what we call an outreach service. So again, we was trying for time in our diary in the afternoon. I said, no problem, I'll meet you at the property and we'll go through moving handling practices, because again, being plus size, you want to make sure the patient's comfortable, dignified, but I see the workforce is also supportive, so they're not overreaching or putting their backs up, strain. And again, that again, collaborating worked really, really well. And they felt it of quite a benefit. So again, they felt supported. And again, the patient didn't require any additional anticipatory medications. So therefore, the relatives was able to have that quality time with them. Mm. Normally, if you do reposition patients, they tend to get quite chesty for secretion. So therefore, you have to give some cytochrome, or they become quite agitated, so some midazolam or some dimorph. So they're actually taking away that quality with the relatives. So that was really nice to hear. So, and I even said to the wife when we arrived, you don't need to leave the room, skin. You're more than welcome to stay, and obviously your husband will want you to be with him. So actually, by all means, you're more than welcome. And again, they have that touch.
Yeah, well, so that really makes medicine so much more accessible to anyone. No one feels left out. You're not limited by your size or your weight, or that there is. It makes the service accessible to everyone. So I think that's brilliant. It's really, really important work, especially in delicate situations, such as end of life care.
Do you like to do this sort of stuff in hospital as well when you have to help out patients?
Yeah, absolutely. So another example is we had a Parkinson's chappie who came into our ophthalmology department. Currently, he's got a moderate to poor core stability, and he wasn't able to sit for the transport. They booked a stretcher. Currently, the transport was like picked him up, but it was like dropping, offloading him. So it became quite rigid. So, they couldn't facilitate his eye test procedure here. So they referred over to the Midlands Eye Hospital. So that's the second visit that he had to facilitate. But unfortunately, they wasn't equipped at the time to accommodate him either. So he was declined back. So obviously, he had come back through to ourselves. And it wasn't until the lead nurse said, I need to get the movement handling team involved because we need to think differently. And absolutely, we always want to collaborate with our areas. So again, I'd always obviously take your Parkinson's medicines as you leave. Obviously, as you get to the hospital, you become less rigid. You can be more able to facilitate movement. And we've got one of our transfer pros. So it's one of our transfer devices that we use in Trust. He stood beautifully, and we managed to get him into the chair, ready to have his retina procedure done, and got him into the room. And it was like, wow, all done within 15 minutes of being on site.
So it could have been avoided.
Absolutely. Yeah. And even his wife wasn't able to transfer in the ambulance with him, so she had to get an Uber. So again, that's obviously a cost pressure to them as patients and service users. And again, it's like, you come for a procedure, you want your next of kin with you, you want your loved one with you. So that's what we were trying to promote, advocate, and actually doing that holistic kind of advocacy around it. Patients' experiences are a lot optimised, and the staff feel supported at the same time. And like I said, it's not going to be my way or the highway, it's how we best work together to achieve the assessment for the patient.
Yeah, that was one of the points I was thinking about, actually, because it sounds like it's a very multidisciplinary team. It's not just you working alone with but you work with a lot of other teams. So what does it look like, say, for instance, with transferring of a patient or with medical devices out in community? What teams might you have to liaise with?
So with devices, we only cover the acute sector. If it's for long-term care, it tends to go under their specialism. So normally, like your nebulizer therapy for your COPD patients, that will then go with the oxygen nurses and COPD nurses. So we do collaborate quite effectively with oxygen therapy nurses, medicines, because again, oxygen being the drug. I also love getting involved with medical devices steering group at the same time to give them the assurance that we are reporting up effectively. Safe medicines practice group. So again, if any medicines are infused with the pump, so again, we have to align up to them. Health and safety assurance group at the same time. So we kind of close link with them, because if anybody has got a work-related injury that's not reportable, we then have to investigate it. So I not only train, kind of prevent and intervene and look at the service needs at the same time.
And like with the operation of these devices, is the training done by a separate team for the patient, or is it operated by staff? They go out into the community, or is it device dependent?
It all is device dependent. So we try and do the acute setting that they are get trained. So like say the nebulizer machine for COPD, then that's then transpired to the nursing staff who will be caring for the patient, and hopefully then you promote patient independence. So obviously you do for your nebulizer now, do you want to start set it up? So let's prepare the patients ready for their discharge. So upon then discharge, then the specialist nurse is then getting involved. So if you say, it's adding that transfer of care into the community.
So what challenges do you like face on a day-to-day basis?
Like I said, every day is a school day. So challenging, it can be regarding is training needs to be cancelled because obviously access to the service demands. It could be that you're being required to support a complex handling requirement, or that we've had an incident where actually the staff haven't correctly followed the procedure with the device. And obviously we then go in to say, actually, it's not a blame game. It's actually learning from incidences. As long as patients are remaining safe. Again, it's as a practitioner, you need to be accountable for obviously what you deliver to your patients. Again, it's then following the instructions. So again, it's coming from all angles.
Mm. So I suppose it's not just limitations to you when these challenges comes. I like how you describe it. It's more of an opportunity to learn, an opportunity to, and it keeps the job exciting as well, because you see a problem and you think, okay, how can we solve this? What new way, what new team can we get involved? How can we go around this to, but ultimately for the benefit of the patient?
Absolutely. No day is the same. Yeah. Every day is completely different.
And did you say it's been since 2016?
2022. In education.
So what made you want to come into this role?
I came on due to health reasons, if I'm truly honest. I had ill health in 2019. Due to the hospital that I accessed at the time not taking my body weight on admission, and I was underdosed with dalteparin, and I developed quite a lot of secondary PEs following initial DVT, and unfortunately I couldn't do 12-hour shifts anymore, because like I said, I was a stroke nurse and I was an advanced stroke nurse as a bleep holder. Again, I've always wanted to be a nurse, and it does hurt me that I can't do patient-facing care anymore. However, this has given me a lot of opportunity to work at a corporate level. So I get to see the organisational running and how actually I have a massive influence on decisions that can be made and take forward that actually still gives patient care.
Yeah, wow. So you've turned that difficulty into a huge strength, and, you know, more so than the immediate feedback from improving patient care in front of you, now you're having a more wider impact affecting, well, essentially training and affecting staff and patients on a much larger scale. So, wow, that's so commendable and inspiring as well.
Yes, yeah. And I must admit, obviously, I also work for a non-profit charity at the same time, but I offer my time, and it's the National Back Exchange. And it's a national charity where experts within the field of movement and handling come to meet, and I am on the board of trustees as an advanced member liaison officer. So it's implementing evidence-based practices, which is proven because they are linked up to Loughborough University from an ergonomics and biomechanics perspective, and it's bringing them practices back into the organisation. So the organisation benefits from me from attending them.
So going back to the Parkinson's patient, how could that have been avoided? Because obviously the patient had to come twice. Do you have any tips?
I think definitely more holistic assessment. Again, it's looking at the initial referral into the patient, where actually a lot of it missing information. So the referring person, which would be the GP, have missed so much more information off there. But actually, if a triage service could have been offered, actually, do we have a way, do we have a mobility status, past medical history status? So actually looking beyond the services, so it's holistically. So putting yourself in that patient's journey, actually, if I come into the hospital, what's going to impact on them? So have we got access needs? Have we got long-term conditions? Where we've got a few pre-planned? This individual, obviously, if urination was quite frequent, so actually, if we know he's got reduced mobility, where's the closest toilet going to be facilitated for them to get him into the department? So things like that. Always look holistically. Always plan for the next step.
So the referrals, were they done by like an email, or is it a form that they fill in?
So we didn't get access to the initial referral, so it's this appointment was allocated to him to come And it was only when the day before they were looking at what their previous day was, and it was one of the shift leads who identified that this individual had accessed the service previously. I went into a bit of a deeper dive on the pre-admission status, and she was like, oh, Midlands IFCO didn't facilitate it because they wasn't prepared, so they referred it back to ourselves. And that's when obviously she escalated to the lead, and the lead obviously then, we need to get the moving handling team involved, again, just to look at complex handling requirements. And that's when we kind of offered, actually, as long as we take the Parkinson's medicines effectively, we'll meet him upon arrival to the hospital. So therefore, we're optimising him at his best to prevent him becoming quite rigid and obviously then not being flexibly moved to obviously tablet cruises, field tests and things like that.
Yeah.
So I think that like works really well with plus size patients as well, because a lot of the time that information is missed out.
And it's just so important that holistic care, as you've mentioned, for a patient, even thinking from the doctor's point of view as well, it goes so much more than just the medication, the diagnosing, but it's looking at the patient as a whole.
The whole,
what is affecting their quality of life,
100%.
What is going to affect them once they're home, and what's important for them, what do they enjoy doing that they can no longer do, for instance, and just being able to impact that, even sometimes in just a little way, can have such a big influence on that patient's quality of life.
100%. And I don't know if you mean my background, but I am such a nosy person. Mm-hmm. So as part of the admission process, when I was working clinically, I'd be speaking to the next of kin. So we not only look after the patient, we're looking after the next of kin, we're looking after the son, daughter. Mm. And it's like, or what he used to do for a living, and it's getting to know them as an individual, not just patient X, for example.
Mm. Can you get a lot of information from the next of kin? Because sometimes patients hide a lot of information.
They do, 100%.
Mm, yeah, and a patient is more than their presenting complaint. Yeah. You know, we're told that all the time. Who's the who's the patient behind the condition? And that's who you want to get to
know.
We
also have to remember that a lot of patients don't want to lose their independence, but there are going to be shortfalls, and family members would be able to let you know that actually they can't do this.
Mm, yeah. And a lot of your work will be giving that patient, you know, as much of that independent as they can afford in some cases, as they can use and they're comfortable with, and also, you know, patient dignity, and that even especially in things like end of life care or chronic conditions, being able to maintain that for the patient and giving them that sense of independence as well can be such a huge thing.
Yeah, it's against preventing deconditioning of the patient, because again, that's ultimately going to affect your length of stay. Because there's the statistics out there, which I think in 2024 the HSA did publish, that those over 65, within the first 48 hours, if they remain in bed, they are 50% more likely to be discharged being incontinent. Again, if we stay in bed for 5 to 7 days, we potentially lose our muscle mass by 10%.
Yeah.
So again, if you feel you've been in bed for a few days and you felt unwell, the first day that you've been up, you've been quite weak, it's because you've become deconditioned and actually you're not utilising the muscle group that you would normally. And all we want to do is try and keep active for longer as much as we can. So not only from a chest perspective, digestion perspective,
yeah,
there's a whole raft of things.
You never really think about these things, but just staying in hospital longer, that, you know, exposed to more bugs for a longer period of time, as you said, they can start to decondition, and then there's new conditions that can crop up with just increased length of stay.
Absolutely.
So even just that alone can have a big impact.
Yes, and I guess what we're trying to do to the staff, we try and teach them how to do a basic mobility assessment. So it's not the physio's responsibility to get somebody out of bed. It's everybody's responsibility. So like I said, you wouldn't have your breakfast in bed. You wouldn't have a wash in bed, would you? So actually what we need to be doing is promoting the bathroom first.
It's encouraging patients to get out of
bed. Absolutely. Obviously, if you're able to physically do it, if you come with a top down TV stroke, you're going to be completely bed down. But actually, those that are able to get out, that's what we need to try and promote. And we've recently reached out to our secondary schools in the local area.
Oh, wow.
So actually, we're trying to do prevention at the same time. So again, it's raising awareness of plus size individuals on how to talk to individuals. Because we know what our teenagers are like. We've been there when we've been at high school. It can be quite a cruel time, but actually it's a massive mental health well-being. But again, it is a long-term condition. So it should be, I'm going to say, Joe Bloggs, who is living with obesity. Like you would say, you're living with diabetes rather than old, the bariatric person.
I think it's interesting because we try to be politically correct, but it might not be the correct term for the patient themselves. Mm-hmm. They might think us calling them bariatric is not the right term. They would want to be called obese or plus size. It's what they, I think we just try to be politically correct, but we don't know what patients want to be called instead.
And it's all about, you know, opening that conversation. Again, on your medical records, obesity, again, if I refer to you, please don't feel like you're going to sound pungent on you at all. Oh no, please refer to me living with obesity or plus size. I always try and advocate plus size because it sounds more nice and gentle. Because you can have a rugby player, believe it or not, who is plus size, but looks perfectly healthy.
Yeah.
So why are we stigmatizing people who are?
We should start using that plus size.
Yeah, absolutely. And the importance, you know, the use of language, it's so important. And I like that you're engaging in that kind of community work and reaching out to the community as well. A lot of medicine as a whole is, if you can prevent the issue from happening in the first place, then there's less issues to then solve later. So at the moment, projects that you're working on at the moment, or any advances that you're...
Yes, so there's quite a few projects that, well, micro projects that I'm working at the moment. So what I really want to try and achieve is that all of our patients that access an inpatient bed are weighed within 4 hours of admission. That's even plus size patients, care of the elderly, pediatrics. So I am kind of working with our colleagues with our resource redesign, and we've successfully managed to get a weighbridge in there, installed in there. So as soon as the patients offload from the ambulance, they go straight on to the weighbridge, and we've got a weight obtained. Again, we'll collaborate the weighing scales. So it's streamlining the services that we provide to meet the wider services out there, such as the acute inpatient. So the acute inpatient, we are now looking at providing a program A, which is advanced techniques of movement handling, compared to a program B. So it is more suited towards your outpatient facilities. So it's your basic techniques. So rather than staff coming from the clinical areas, they can come in the appropriate program, which is tailored to their needs. Again, putting the service demands first and putting everything and resources back into them. We do community outreach as well at the same time. So again, that's training based at Brierley Hill. I have obviously offered my time to go towards career events, again, trying to promote careers for the NHS, that there is 350 professions, not only doctors and nurses, there's others out there. So actually it's trying to promote that to the future workforce at the same time. So it's instilling your vision that actually you kind of left a legacy kind of thing. But again, I always say it's not my way or the highway, it's just what's best for our patients and our service users and then staff.
So you were saying that one of your projects is weighing patients within 4 hours of ambulance offload. That is so important because half the time you're still trying to figure out what the patient's weight is if you have to give them medications.
Yeah.
Or 4 hours to an admission to a hospital bed. So honestly, it's within ED. Again, it all depends if there's patient flow. There could be an emergency department, but there also could be accommodating patients that are waiting to be admitted to an inpatient bed. So that's why we're like, for those patients that need to have their body weight, reach out to us. We'll come down. We'll help you weigh the patient. By all means, we've got bed scales at the same time. We've got hoist scales. We are quite lucky, like I says. So we're going to have a weighbridge in the resource. So we can just put the bed on there, go weigh straight away. Me and my team, we've also weighed different products. So, and we've devised a list. So actually, if they've got a soft foam mattress or a dynamic mattress, we take X amount of kilograms off. Bed sheets, blankets, two pillows, X amount of kilograms off. The remaining weight would be patient's body weight. So again, it's trying to literally streamline everything. So it's all there for the wider team to utilize.
And it's just to help that flow of the service at the end of the day. It just improves efficiency and improve the quality at the end of the day of care that the patient gets. If they have to... If we don't have to delay one extra hour before a medication gets given or before they're seen by a certain specialty or a member of staff, all of that adds up in the end. And if we can do that patient after patient, then it just helps the service to then flow as we imagine it should flow in an ideal world. And
ideal world, yes.
I suppose that the goal is pushing more and more towards that ideal and coming up with ideas and how we can improve things. So yeah, those are very brilliant projects. And you know, it's a mixed bag of community work as well as training our current staff as well as innovative ideas that we can use to improve what we've got.
It's take your pride in what you deliver. If you're going, we all come into healthcare to make things better for our patients, but actually I now look after staff at the same time, so my kind of passion's just kind of widened a little bit.
I feel like I have to do my manual handling mandatory training again.
I mean, that's a big takeaway though, isn't it? It's, you know, it's not just the OT, PT that will move.
Yeah, as a doctor, we should be able to like
handle
a patient.
So just as an FYI, we're now doing medical students training and FY1s and FY2s. Yeah.
Oh, wow. So our students can get involved as well in training of these. Oh, that is brilliant.
As of October, we'll be taking on our first medical students.
Wow.
Following initial trial and feedback, and they felt it was a real benefit.
Yeah.
Because they always felt they're always going to achieve their clinical skills, but actually the patient needs support and they want to offer support, but they don't know how to move and handle them.
Yeah.
So we trialled it and it evaluated really well. So we're starting with the October cohort.
Yeah. That's brilliant. It one less thing to learn on the job.
Yeah, and it helps a lot because if, say, a patient is being moved from one department to another, sometimes that department doesn't have enough staff to handle the patient. So if you're there, you should be able to help the basics. Yeah,
absolutely. Because what we deliver is evidence-based. You can actually move and handle a patient with a hands-off approach, believe it or not.
If you just know what instructions to give.
Technique
to use. Ah.
So the slide sheets to slide your patient up the bed, but you haven't got to roll your patient to get the slide sheets underneath them. There's techniques out there. And I always say it in training, the film Dirty Dancing, this is my dance space, that's your dance space. You never want to overreach outside your dance space. So this is exactly the same philosophy around that. So promote your patient to roll independent and look in the direction of travel. But as soon as they come to you, you stay in that position, you don't need to. But then actually the technique, you can just fold the slide sheet up and unravel underneath the patient from feet to toe.
Yeah. Wow.
So a lot of this training is not mandatory for some of the staff. How can we get involved if we want to get this training?
It's just literally reaching out to us. We offer in our minute load training, we offer emergency equipment training. Obviously, we're going to go with induction and refresher A, induction and refresher B programs, all available on our internet page here in the hospital. Just drop us an email. We've got our team email, which is coreskills@nhs.net. Always happy to offer advice support. We have a mobile with full triage at the same time. So if there's a bit of over the phone advice, someone's always allocated. Again, for complex handling needs, we've got a bleep. So again, we can be there more quicker. Because again, you don't always get a phone reception in the hospital. So there's many different ways. And again, there's the email. We always say, if you drop us an email, please allow for 2 working days for us to reply to you. Or there is an extension, which is obviously where my office is based. The extension number can always give us a ring on that one.
If you are looking for the team, you'll find either from the email or the intranet, as you said, or a phone call. Brilliant. Just being wary of our time on the podcast, are there any final thoughts that you think would be useful for our viewers to know? So we have an audience of staff members, but also people in community are also listening in. Any final thoughts?
I would always say good back care would be primarily, and always try and facilitate beautiful movement handling principles. But believe it or not, as a child, toddlers do beautiful movement handling. It becomes learned behaviour when, as we get older in society, where we tend to bend at the hips rather than at the knees. So again, putting our lumbar region at risk, putting our back at risk of herniation of discs. So you just look after your own musculoskeletal health and keep hydrated.
Keep hydrated, look after your musculoskeletal health, look
bend
after your
at
back.
The knees.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Thank you so much, Paul. Thank you so much for coming on. It's been a wonderful conversation and learning about what you do, learning about your department. And I'm sure our audience as well have learned so much as I have today. If you would like to take part on the podcast, feel free to contact the team. From our discussions today, we'll have links and contacts in the descriptions. And do interact with us as well. Send your comments, let us know your thoughts, and we will sure to watch out for your engagement as well. So that comes to the end of the podcast. See you next time.
See you next time.
Remember to stay connected with us on social media. Follow us on Instagram and TikTok at RGUCMS. And subscribe to our YouTube channel, RGUC Media, for more exclusive content and updates. Thanks for tuning in to the Right Chamber podcast. Until next time.